Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlotnik. Today, it is my pleasure and a privilege to welcome another brother from the Collective Genius Mastermind, Nick Allerud. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Nick Double A, right? That's what they call you?
Nick Double A. That's good enough. Got a hard last name.
it's all good. And Nick hails from New England, from Boston area. Do you live in Boston Prime, or what do you call it?
No.
City itself?
No one can afford to actually live in the city, Mike. No, just kidding. Just kidding. I am from the proud home of Tom Brady and the Patriots, and I just had half your viewers turn this off. But I'm about 20 minutes north of Boston, a little town called Billerica. So it's very close to the city, though. Yeah.
Got you. And I guess you're a hardcore New England fan. So
I mean, you know, it's hard not to be when you live up here. So. You know, we've had the longstanding Yankees Red Sox relationship for a very long time. So,
yeah, I mean, in the age of Roman Empire, they had the Colosseum. They had the fights and people died fighting. Now they have the sports.
That's true.
It's a whole lot better to do it this way than any other way. So.
That's true. Less blood, but a lot more money is exchanged. So,
yes, for sure. For sure. And certainly they've improved the safety for the players. Nick, you do a lot of fix and flips in the New England area. Let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, a couple of words about you. Do you have family, kids, cats, dogs, wives? I don't know.
Sure. Yep. Absolutely. No. Started out, me personally, I have two amazing, amazing kids. They're our why. They're what we do every day. And my whole goal is to basically take them to 90% of every country on earth and expose them to local culinary cuisine. That's like my big dream, is to take these kids everywhere. And, that's essentially,
how old are the kids?
Just 5 and 3. Starting them young.
No worries. All good.
Yeah. So that's pretty much what they have now. And, it started out in real estate 2005, 18 years ago. Gosh, I don't even know. No.
Time flies. 15 years, almost 14 years, something like that.
14 years. Yeah. And, I was a hotshot banker before that at Mellon Bank here in Boston. And it was not a very sexy job. It sounds a lot better than it really was. And, I understood numbers, jumped into real estate in a really hard way, got my first 5 deals. My whole story is, it involves a shampoo bottle being my accountability partner. It involves, me being angry at myself for not doing deals fast enough. So I got involved in 5 deals with a partner out of state I didn't really know. And this is the story a lot of people already know about me, but that ended up in a terrible, terrible way. I ended up with a little bit of fraud involved on my partner's side. I basically, first 5 deals in real estate, I came from a hotshot banker in Boston, 800 credit score, lots of money in the bank, and ended up kind of on my back with, credit score around 400 and 450,000 in debt. And I had to restart a real estate business with that. And it was, that was hard. But that's the story most people know. Happy to get it. Whatever people have questions, I'm happy to get into it. Otherwise, we can move on from there. But started there in real estate and restarted as a wholesaler, got into fix and flipping in 2008-09, and really haven't looked back. We started a short sale mitigation firm, me and my partner, Marianne Little. We have a short sale company where we service a lot of our Brotherhood CG members across the country, as well as a whole bunch of agents, brokers, and investors in the New England area. We have a property management company, which manages for in excess of over 100 units in different states, Mass, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Florida. And, building my job these days is going after what you love, the sexy, larger cash flow assets that have solid underwriting. And that has become my new full-time job, along with keeping my team energized and supported in the office for the single family stuff. So it's kind of neat. It's neat.
Thank you for that great intro. So let me ask you two follow-up questions to that. What number one question, what's the lessons learned from that rough experience that you had? And the second question is, where do you find good cash flow in real estate in today's environment? So start with the first question.
Awesome questions. And getting right to it, right? The lessons learned. For me, that was my very first, what I call hard reset button, right? And I've had three or four since then, but that was my very, very first. So honestly, the biggest lesson that I had at that moment was to learn to get back up on the horse, right? To get to stand back up in that ring. And not just, I was an ostrich. I put my head in the sand for about 4 or 5 months, didn't really know what to do, and just sort of buried myself in my, I still, thank God, had a W-2 job at that. I was still, you know, a banker, but if they checked my credit, I'd lose my job. So I just sort of buried my head in the sand and slowly had to overcome a fear of the phone. My phone was ringing off the hook with the collections calls from those, you know, five homes that I had purchased. And I had a fear of talking to people. I had fear of picking up the phone. I had a weird phobia of even the ringtone on a phone. So restarting and wholesaling, that was kind of the biggest accomplishment, I guess, is I had to overcome that fear in order to restart my business where I knew I needed to be to give myself that freedom that I needed to, you know, not have to work 60, 70 hour weeks at the bank. So that was a big one. There's a few others, you know, learning to do my own due diligence with partnerships, learning that, also taking ownership, right? And I spent, this is the last I'll say to it. I spent 6 to 8 to 9 months being just angry, right, at this other person, other individual. And I really couldn't let it go until someone told me. It was actually Marshall Silver, the national hypnotist. You might know him. I mean, he basically just said, you know, own it. This was your failure. You know, no matter what he did, you went through with it. You didn't do enough due diligence. You didn't, you know, why buy out of state your first five deals and just own it. You made this mistake. And once I kind of owned that for myself, it really helped propel me forward to sharpen my pencil. And I couldn't afford to lose money again, right? So I had to learn the strategies that I could use that didn't require an awful lot of cash or credit, but still required a heck of an amount of time of me putting down rules, systems, and procedures in place to, okay, I can't lose money. So how do I buy this piece of real estate? I can't lose money. So how do I negotiate with the seller? I can't lose money. So how do I work with this contractor? Right.
Yeah. I think it's a great, these are great lessons learned. You know, I certainly agree with you that due diligence, learning through due diligence is absolutely the key, right? And owning your own, failures or successes is important. And, indomitable spirit, you fall, you get up, right? And that's another key lesson. So makes a lot of sense. I appreciate you sharing. It's not easy to share, but it shows you're not afraid to share even failures, which is it's a sign of strength. Anyway, now let's talk about the good stuff. So today's environment, cash flow is hard to find. What do you find again? You know, Boston area like New York City, cap rates are extremely low. Everything trades at a crazy multiple. What do you find cash flowing deals?
I'm curious on the New York side too, Mike. We saw for a period of time here in the Boston area, we had negative cap rates. Did you have that in the city?
I haven't seen negative cap rates. There's a concept of negative interest rates, and it's certainly well known. It happens in Japan and in Europe, but I have not seen negative cap rates. What does happen, and I think what you're referring to is phenomenon that you need to put in a massive down payment to break even, right? So you the cap rates are still positive, but the cap rate is a whole lot below the mortgage rate. So if the cap rate is 3 and a mortgage rate is 4.5, every dollar that you borrow actually creates negative leverage in essence. So people still borrow because they want leverage depreciation. So things say you have 1.5% negative between the cap rate and the interest rate. The cash flow gets the more money you borrow, the more negative cash flow you have. But right. if your appreciation is 10% a year, I mean, you make up through the appreciation. So from that perspective, maybe you're referring to that. It's sort of, it's not a negative cap rate. It's just a, is that what you're talking about or something else?
Yeah, we had a phenomenon here in the city where there was an awful lot of out of the country capital that was just looking to get out of their countries and bring it to the US in the form of real estate purchases. And there was a big hub of that in the city. So they were, but exactly like you mentioned, they were overbuying so that there was a highly negative cash flow, but number one, they were getting out of their country. And number two, they were banking on the growth aspect, you know, 10, 15 years down the line, I assume with market appreciation.
I think we're talking about the same thing. It's interesting what you said. They're not negative cap rates. Ultimately, if they bought the whole thing for cash, right?
Yeah.
Unless literally they buy something and it's losing money. I mean, it does happen. Real estate assets can lose money through the value add life part of a life cycle. But generally speaking, right, you're not buying a piece of real estate when it's fully performing, it's actually going to lose money. I mean, I guess these situations do happen, but absolutely abnormal.
It is for sure. And it's funny you mentioned that because it's a great topic where I know you and I believe in this very strongly. Like we do not and would never purchase any asset class banking on market appreciation, right? Like, and I know that you and I totally agree on, we want solid fundamentals on cash flow. And for us specifically, to answer your direct question, right, where are we finding cash flowing assets in this particular market cycle? You and I also are very alike where we do feel like there's different asset classes where we're at the very top and there's other ones that are maybe haven't been discovered, right? Or used to be dangerous and are maybe now more opportunistic. But I was involved in specifically multifamily syndication in 2009, 2010, 2011. And, you know, having done the due diligence for larger complexes and underwriting and checking the bank statements and, you know, rent rolls and all that, I have to tell you, on the just specifically cash flow side, I can find a 12-unit building, if we're just talking multifamily, because I know you deal in multiple asset classes, but just talking multifamily, I can make more money by executing one of the, you know, cash out refinance strategies on a 12 unit building local to me versus going to an emerging market, right? Going to, you know, Dallas or going to, you know, Georgia or going anywhere else and buying a 400 unit syndicating with other equity partners. I can make more money on a 12 unit building here locally, cash flow wise, than I can doing the big ones. So that's really where we refocused about 3 years ago. How many 4 to 6 to 12 to 24 unit buildings can we accumulate locally that, you know, we don't necessarily need to raise a fund. We don't need to do a whole bunch of syndication, but I'll tell you, I like it and it's not as sexy. But when you mentioned you only, cause you asked me specifically cash flowing assets, that's what we were focusing on, just building our inventory. Now it doesn't mean that we're not going for the big growth deals like we mentioned before, like a large development project we have where we feel it's a solid move and that it will still cash flow once it's developed. We're still going for big growth opportunities, but if we're just talking about accumulation, we're going for those 6 to 12 to 24.
So how do you make money on this? Again, just let's just break it down a little bit. So you find an asset, a small, let's just say, you know, small multifamily. Anything over four doors is sort of known as technically a multifamily. Mm-hmm. So you buy it, you fix it, you rent it and refi. Is that the strategy?
That's, yep. Same as what everybody in Bigger Pockets has renamed the Burr strategy. We used to call it the No Cash Left Behind Act of 2009, but that was a long time ago.
Right. But yes, from the Burr strategy it's a kind of real estate 101. If you're going to keep real estate, you certainly want to come in at a discounted price. And if you have the ability to rehab, run through the value add cycle, and then take out the original money, and that strategy is solid, has been solid for a long time, as long as you can execute. And to you, it sounds like you got a property management and you got the rehabbing capability. So this is pretty basic stuff. I mean, you could keep turning those things and small assets. Again, they're not necessarily bad assets at all. They in fact, they're great assets. If you can, it's much easier to manage, you know, a small renovation than a big project. So your exit happens to take place a whole lot faster. So from that perspective.
I think you just nailed it though, Mike, when you said about property management. So I became obsessed, especially after another, we won't get into it in your podcast, but another hard reset in 2010, 2011, which I briefly mentioned to you before we started recording. And I, because of what happened then, I became completely obsessed with property performance. And, you know, if all the shit hits the fan, as they say, you know, we had to fire a large third-party property management company. I needed to know, I wanted to have a firm that was able to then execute on the vision for that property, right? I needed to be able to know the intricacies and know how to deal with tenants and how to deal with vendors and how to deal with contractors and, how to phase things in, how to enforce value adds, to know what to do. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that background of a property management, you know, yes, you can hire third parties all day long, but I really truly believe that you should know pretty much what they're supposed to be doing to help service your asset on a day-to-day basis. And if you don't have that knowledge, you should get it, right? You should learn and hire people and work with a fund like yours that knows the ins and outs and can partner with people like that. So,
yeah, that's a great point. I've talked to many successful operators like you, many CG guys and outside, and that is a secret sauce to being able to manage a whole bunch of small assets is you have in-house property management. You could certainly outsource, and I do use outsource property management, but you always have the questions, are they running things correctly? Are they, you know, skimming you for whatever? Are they, you know, are the repairs legit or not? And the bottom line is if you have your own property management and you manage your own assets and external assets, you certainly can have the economy of scale and you could have confidence that this is the way to do this. Right. For your own assets, obviously, and external. So it makes a lot of sense. So besides the bird strategy, what else do you like in Boston area? I mean, that strategy is basic. It happens in every market. If you can find, you know, all the properties, all the stock, and you can renovate and refi them, and it's a question of capability and finding the deal flow.
That's true. But I wanted to measure that against so many people are now syndicating for those 200 to 400 unit deals, right? And I just literally put them up on an Excel sheet together to find out what helped increase the bottom line cash flow for my company. Right. And when you do that, it was hands down the winner. But yet other opportunities here.
You realize why people are looking for bigger deals, right? It's the economy of scale. It's
totally
they want to have one transaction, one asset. In theory, it is easier to manage. In practice, it depends. Right? You could manage a whole bunch of, some people successfully manage portfolios of single families, quads, triplexes, and, you know, small multifamily, as you mentioned, you know, 10, 15, 16, 20 doors. And they do a whole lot better than managing one big asset. So from that perspective, one of the main benefits is you have ability to sell off, you know, individual assets versus, you know, once you own one asset, you're stuck with it. So there's certainly pros and cons, but people try to acquire larger assets because of the economy of scale. You have, generally speaking, one transaction, one mortgage, and in theory, better economics. If you can't extract the value out of economy of scale, then, you know, it's no good. One of the problems today is the pricing, right? The pricing for the these larger assets is such that the economics, it's basically the cap rate on multifamilies is a whole lot worse than a bunch of smaller assets. Right? That's probably why your cash flow on small assets is actually per dollar invested works a whole lot better than on a bigger assets. But return on time is another question, right? I mean, are you getting return on time or not?
Correct. I didn't want to be negative on the larger asset classes because I used to be involved and I still 100% believe in them for what you just said, all the economies of scale. It really just truly depends on your own financial goals, right? And I'm still invested. I'm still an LP in a bunch of them, and your fund specifically, right? It's I love one roof over 12 roofs all day long. Right. But it becomes critical, which we already agreed with, is on that performance aspect, right? There are great third party management companies out there to help work with the sponsor. And there are ones that once you have to fire one, right, your cash flow goes down. And I just want to make sure that whoever's doing that knows the ins and outs of that, how to operate, just in case they have to, right? So that's good.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. It's a contrast to what the crowd is thinking, or you know, many investors would like to put their money in a larger syndication. So as an LP, you're passive. You're just getting the income. Assuming there's a very competent GP who can run the asset well. But the key question is the GP getting good enough deal? You as an LP investing in a good enough syndication, good enough value add? And that's a great question. It is not, there's no straight answer other than, you know, you got to do your due diligence. So from that perspective, one of the challenges, and again, I've talked to a few other CTU guys and I've talked to them that, listen, if you're really good at these single family or, you know, duplex quad and you're building portfolios, all that stuff, and you want to grow and expand, I've talked to a few folks and I said, listen, you could just do a fund and you can take LPs into the fund and you can execute on your strategy and raise capital and keep doing what works rather than trying to look for bigger assets that are no longer your core expertise, for the reason that you're trying to buy more or bigger transaction, but you're no longer in your, you know, niche. It's in the niche changes. And the interesting thing, again, from LP perspective, most LPs want to be passive. The reason, and people have bought turnkeys, right? I mean, the whole discussion about turnkeys, you could go passively buy, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 door property, get a third-party property manager, and get cash flow out of it. And the primary struggle with that from some of the, you know, wealthy LPs is that they don't want to manage the manager. They don't want to be involved. They just want to write a check and then enjoy passive income. And you really have another property with another tax return. So it's kind of a trade-off. So
yeah.
Any thoughts on this? I don't know. I mean, from your perspective.
I totally agree. So I'm an LP. Well, it's funny because we don't have time to talk on your podcast about it, but at 2011, you'll see my presentation on the, you know, what happened with me with my brush with the SEC, as they say. I was not on the general partner level. I was an LP, but I was also helping them raise some equity for a few deals. That, you know, won't say any names here, but it was in the Boston area and I learned a lot. I learned, my goal was to try to get more information on the performance and operations side. And in doing that, I helped them raise some equity. And I was an LP there. I was an LP with another national guru syndicator. And both LPs, because of this investment sponsor, literally just stopped responding to the quarterly call, stopped communicating with us. And that was a problem. And it was a national guru who still teaches to this day how to do apartment buildings and how to buy, you know, and manage apartment buildings and buy 7,000 units. And you don't need to start with one house, buy 7,000. And, you know, that investment went to zero. And people need to, I think, know that if you have a bad sponsor, or even if you have a sponsor that's not inherently bad or malicious, but just doesn't know how to deal with issues, right? And stops communicating, which is the number one sin you can do as a sponsor, right? If he stops communicating, that's when all the issues happen. That's when someone calls the SEC. That's when an investigation is launched. That's when assets are all completely frozen. And if you can't operate or cash flow the asset or pay the debt service while that's happening, you lose the asset. It goes away. And your investment as an LP literally goes to zero. That's what happened to me on that national guru, and as well as that Boston group in Boston here that I was helping raise equity for. So it was rough.
Well, I so much appreciate you sharing, because it's really, you brought up a couple of critical points, and folks who listen to the podcast, they educate themselves in due diligence and they educate themselves how to invest better. And one of the key points is don't believe the hype. Don't believe the gurus.
That's right. 100%.
All these massive promoters, the stuff that's heavily promoted is generally crap. I'm sorry to say this, but there is no better way to put it. The deals that are not promoted and they come through the word of mouth and referral and quality sponsors are often much better than the deals that just pushed out there through social media, through emails. And the reason they get so much promotion because they're crappy deals, right? You can't raise good money. Sophisticated people run away from them. So they go after mom and pop investors or people who don't know better. And then unfortunately, too many, and it's a promoter's exemption. People who promote don't necessarily need to be part of the deal. They just get paid to promote as long as, you know, it's not a proportion of the capital they raise, which is, you know, broker dealer kind of a fee requirement, but they just promote the deal. The problem is their audience just been kind of, I want to call them, is led to be, you know, sitting there with an open wallet and no clue what they're investing in. Unfortunately, there's too many of these people. And all I can tell you is, this is an example. It's a great example, and thank you for sharing that. If you're ready to invest, do the due diligence. Don't let a big name celebrity personality take your money just because they have a name recognition. The deal should be solid and they should have a strong track record. And another key point you said, ability to solve problems is the key. Too many people can't solve problems. When things are running well, everything runs well. But when there's a problem and they are not able to solve problem, by the way, that's a number one skill of a sponsor, right? Not to be able to maximize the assets when things are perfect, right? I mean, that's an important skill too. But what is important is when things don't run well. How do you make sure that you salvage the asset for your investors? How do you survive downturn? How do you manage stress conditions?
Stress test the deal, right? I'm sure, I know you do that too. Stress test every deal. 100%.
Right. Stress testing of a deal helps quite a bit. We are sort of running out of time. Let's just jump to a couple of quick things. You have a book. You mentioned before the podcast recording, you have a book out. What is the book? How would people find you and find the book?
Sure. No, I appreciate it. It's funny because it's similar to what I just shared with you. My first reset button, my first hard reset button that I talk about. We pushed out a book. It's got a few celebrities in it. It's got the promoter of Jim Rohn, Kyle Wilson, Lisa Hesha, Speaker TV host, Todd Stottlemyre, 3X World Series winning pitcher. It's kind of cool. It's just a book. It's called Don't Quit: Stories of Persistence, Courage, and Faith. And it is an Amazon bestseller. We're pretty proud of it. And it's got a whole bunch of our stories in it. I'm a co-author with a bunch of really cool people that have a lot of kind of encouraging and reset stories, if you will. And the first one is the one I sort of shared with you today, my first five deals gone bad and how I had to recover from that. But I'm just one of many incredible stories in that book. They can just check it out. It's right on Amazon. It's called Don't Quit: Stories of Persistence, Courage, and Faith. So it's a good, great book. I don't make any money from it. All the profits go to charity. It's just kind of a way to push ourselves out there. So thanks for the plug. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm Amazon searching right now. The book is called Don't Quit. The best things. Well, that's something else. There's so many books. There's a number of books called Don't Quit.
There is. It's Don't Quit, and then Stories of Persistence, Courage, and Faith. If you type in Stories of Persistence, you'll probably get it.
Got it. Okay. Cool. Appreciate that. If folks wanted to get in touch with you to ask you a few more questions or to chat about your business, what's the best way to get a hold of you? Is there a website, email?
Sure. Yep. Most of them can find me on Facebook. I'm Nick Allerud. It's funny because I'm going to tell you, this is a first for you on your podcast, Big Mike, because you are the last in the phone book and I'm the very first in the phone book. So we are both celebrities in our own right. So just saying. But
yes, I'm used to that. People used to call me, you know, last but not least, right?
It was better than the prank phone calls I got when I was little at the house. Like, did you know you're first in the phone book? And they hang up. But they can find me on Facebook, Nick with AALERUD. They can also check us out. It's aarealestategroup.com is my company. And I'm happy to chat with anybody. I love it. So
I appreciate your wisdom. Appreciate your sharing. Thank you kindly.
Thank you, Mike. It was great being here, man. Thanks for the invite.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.